Okay. Again, we are doing another Dave and Amber show, and we got a great guest today. We got Mark Heyman, who is, I guess I would call him an expert on the psychology of diabetes. Is that correct, Mark?
Yeah, I call myself a diabetes psychologist or an expert on the psychology of diabetes, exactly.
So, like we do with all of our guests, why don't you share with us kind of your diabetes journey? How did this all come about?
Sure. Well, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes on June the 1st, 1999. I was a third-year student at UCLA, and I was,
your Bruins lost the other day. You know, I'm very sorry about that.
We're not talking about that right now.
Why are we even going into that? I know this is we're not talking about that.
but I as a lifelong Bruin, that's par for the course. So them losing, I mean,
that's okay. I'm a lifelong Fighting Illini, and you know, I didn't even make it that far. So.
So anyway, I was in my third year at UCLA, and I, you know, just busy and feeling just stressed out. And I wish I could remember how long I was sick. I really don't know. I remember at least for a couple of weeks, you know, getting up in the middle of the night, going to the bathroom, feeling tired, all that stuff. But what was really on my mind at the time was I had an internship lined up in Paris. I'd been studying French for 7 or 8 years by then, and I was about to leave to go to Paris. And I thought to myself, I cannot be sick right now. I cannot be sick right now because if I'm sick, I can't go to France. So finally, it came to a point where I was walking to class and I just couldn't get there. I had no energy. So I made a detour to the student health center and let them know what was going on. And I remember a doctor came in to see me and he asked me what was going on. And I told him, and he runs out of the room and gets the blood glucose meter, picks my finger, and the meter said hi. And he had no idea what that meant. He had to run back out of the room and look for the manual to see what high actually meant. And when he found out it was 600 plus,
wow,
he pushed me into a chair and they called an ambulance. And so an ambulance came to the student health center. Actually, that's not true. The ambulance came to the parking lot across from the student health center. And I was put on a gurney and wheeled across the entire quad at UCLA in front of everyone I knew and didn't know, and taken to UCLA Medical Center, where I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Didn't stay in the hospital, was released that night, and was told to go see a very nice endocrinologist the next day named Ann Peters.
Oh my God, you were treated by Ann. Oh, that's amazing. Okay, go ahead.
I was.
Well, you know what else is amazing? Hold on, is that we're talking like how so many people are misdiagnosed or they don't really catch it. You're in a student health situation, and that doctor was, I'm going to say, smart enough to realize, hey, shit has hit the fan with this, and we've got to take action immediately. So good on that doctor, really.
For sure, for sure. So I went home, and the next morning went to see Ann Peters. I spent about 3 hours with her. She gave me a crash course in diabetes, and at the end of our appointment, she says, "Do you have any questions?" And I timidly said, well, yeah, I do have one question. I have a trip planned to France in about 2.5 weeks. I guess that means my trip is off. And she looked at me like I was a little bit crazy. And she's like, why? And I was like, you mean I can go? And she's like, absolutely. So 18 days after my diagnosis, I got on a plane and flew to France and spent the summer in Paris, emailed with Dr. Peters all summer long, letting her know my blood sugars. And she made adjustments to my NPH and my regular insulin.
So let's go back just a quick step. So you were on multiple daily injection therapy when you started.
But that was probably just 2 shots a day, right?
No, I was taking 2 shots of NPH, I believe. And then I was taking regular, like a sliding scale of regular. So I was taking injections with every meal.
Okay.
Okay. Are you still on an MDI or are you?
I'm not. I use a pump now.
Okay. And which pump are you on now?
I use a Tandem Control IQ.
Okay. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Just one.
Yeah. So I spent the summer in France, and you know, looking back on it, I mean, I had a great time. I had no clue about what I was doing. I remember a couple of things. I remember going low one time, and this is back before the euro, where it was francs, and I had no idea how to count francs to figure out how to actually buy a soda from the machine. I remember like sweating and trying to buy a soda from the machine and not knowing even what I was doing. But that being said, I survived. And you know, whenever I meet a new patient who has diabetes, and all my patients have diabetes, one of the first things I ask them is, tell me about your diagnosis. Because what I find from my own experience and from theirs is that your diagnosis tells a lot about how you're going to handle diabetes emotionally moving forward. Where you give it a message that you can, or that diabetes is not going to stop you, Or were you given a message that diabetes is going to get in your way and going to cause you all kinds of problems? And those messages really impact people. And I don't know where I would be right now if Dr. Peterson said, you know what, you can't go to France. You need to stay home this summer and, you know, take care of your health. I hope I'd be in the same place, but I don't know. But getting off on that right foot, knowing, having the message sent to me that diabetes will not get in your way and you can go to France 18 days after your diagnosis was powerful. And I think it's really led me to where I am today in helping people to navigate those challenges and to get those messages reframed in a positive way.
Now, if you could, and I'm not trying to pigeonhole you, but I'm,
yeah,
you know, just for our listeners, if you could like categorize like the three biggest issues you run into and how they're dealt with, maybe that would help a lot.
Yeah. So I'm going to answer that in a couple of different ways. So I would say the biggest issues that I deal with in my work are people who have a fear of lows is a really big one. People who are feeling like I'm going to say diabetes burnout in kind of as a broad category, but really people who are having trouble adjusting to life with diabetes, whether that's newly diagnosed or whether that's 20 years after their diagnosis. So still having trouble adjusting there. And then another category is people who are having, you know, relationship problems. You know, how do I deal with my mom or my wife or something like that? But on a broader category, really, what I see is those issues are all there. However, the way they all come together is they keep people stuck. They hold people back from doing the things that they want to do. And so the way I think about diabetes and mental health is diabetes is stressful and there's not much we can do to make diabetes less stressful. There's things we can do, you know, using different therapies and, you know, different mindsets, but there's a baseline level of stress. And how do we help people to navigate the world and not let that stress hold them back? And so if we're able to help people to move forward and do what they want to do in their lives, even if they're feeling burnt out, even if they're feeling anxious, even if they're feeling stressed in whatever way, then all of a sudden they become free and flexible. And so the symptoms of burnout or fear of lows, those are all barriers. But the real goal is not to get rid of the burnout or the fear of lows, but take the barrier down and let people do what they want to do without letting diabetes get in their way.
Now, you mentioned, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the three of us were all diabetic. You know, we've all experienced a low, a high, and all that stuff. I'm curious with your first point that you mentioned with the fear of lows, and given the advent of continuous monitoring, I've heard, and I've never had this fear, but, you know, a lot of people do. There are some people who don't want to be on devices, don't want to be attached to anything. Do you run into that?
All the time.
And how do you deal with that? Because, I mean, I think we would all agree that CGM is probably the most transformative technology ever introduced to diabetes. Okay. Everybody, you know, everybody who's on it, once they're on it, seems to love it. I love it. I know Amber likes it. And I'm sure you like it. I mean, you're on the control like you. How do you deal with that when somebody says, you know, I don't want to be, you know, attached?
Well, I have to say something to that too, because I have never been on an insulin pump because I don't want to be attached to something. CGM, I only got on a CGM after helping a children's diabetes camp. And I saw these little kids doing it. I was like, I remember there's no reason why you shouldn't do this. So there's not a fear necessarily, but yeah, I just don't want to make that transition. Period. So I'm saying that because I want to hear what you have to say as a person who is living that.
Yeah. My advice to people is give it a try. It's not permanent. You can use it for a week and take it off. Use it for a day and take it off if it's not for you. But I will say, as transformative as CGM is for everyone that I've met, including myself, it has some downsides in terms of fear of lows, because never before have we been able to see our blood sugars in real time every 5 minutes and know exactly where they're going and trending. And so for people who have a fear of lows, actually one of the biggest things we work on is actually putting the CGM aside, letting it alert, letting it do its job without looking at it all the time. How many times have I, and I'm sure you guys, have gotten up in the middle of the night and the first thing that you do is look at your CGM?
Always.
Who cares? I mean, I say that facetiously, but who cares what your blood sugar is in the middle of the night? As long as you feel okay and as long as it's not alerting you. Why do we do that? But now your brain is constantly, what's my blood sugar? What's my blood sugar? And some people handle that just fine. But people who have a fear of lows, it's this constant, like we're on a phone call right now, we're doing a podcast, what's my blood sugar? And it's always on your mind. And when something's always on your mind, it gets in your way.
Well, you know, it's funny. It is so funny that you say that, because I have two kind of anecdotes here. I just went on the Omnipod 5. Okay. I was, you know, and I'm loving it. But I have to say, it has been the spookiest thing for me, because I have an alarm. I'm like, so I'm, you know, I was like the other day, I was on the golf course. I'm like, you know, God, I have an alarm. I'm like, am I all right? You know, it's like, you know, and I think I even sent my a picture of my blood sugars to Amber. And I said, I'm flatline. I've never flatlined, you know? And then, and the other funny thing was, I have a very close friend of mine. He's type one, kind of like Amber, loves MDI, won't go on a pump, but I got him on a CGM. And I said, Mike, you're going to be overloaded with data. Okay. You're going to have to learn kind of how to manage this. Do you find that true where like it's an avalanche of all this data and people don't know what to do with it?
Yeah. And again, it depends on people's personality and levels of anxiety. Some people deal with it just fine. And it just kind of rolls off of them. Like I'll use myself as an example. You know, I look at my CGM probably 200 times a day, but it's more of a nervous habit as opposed to something that's trying to calm my anxiety. But there are some people who, you know, they want to know what their blood sugars are constantly. And it's this avalanche of data for them, which then becomes overwhelming, the data does. But then it also feeds the anxiety. So it's like the anxiety monster, which is then, you know, being fed.
Yeah.
And then there's another set of people, I will say, who don't trust their CGM.
Yeah.
Sometimes they have good data as to why. You know, they have evidence that says that my CGM is always not, it's always off base. And so, but then there's some people who just don't trust it because they don't. And they always say, the question I always have for people is, why do you trust a finger stick more than a CGM?
Well,
that's what I've always done. I'm like, well, then, I mean, we need to reframe that because maybe the CGM is actually more accurate than the finger stick.
Well, you know, it's crazy that you mentioned that because I just wrote a new blog post about people are trusting a finger stick, which is actually less accurate than a CGM. If you look at data, I mean, most people just assume that a finger stick is accurate because we're using blood. But a finger stick could be off as much as 20%.
And there's more room for error. I mean, if your hands aren't, I mean, there's all kinds of factors there.
Oh, yeah. And a CGM, the room for error now, we're down to like 7-8%. You know, so it's almost ironic that you say that. And then I wanted to go back to another point that you made because it really is perfect for our listening audience because as much as we talk to patients with diabetes, we really are talking to the people that they touch. And you had mentioned that diabetes, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, gets in the way of relationships. Can you expound on that?
Yeah. So it goes both ways. So getting in the way of, so, you know, imagine that you're feeling burnt out with diabetes or you're feeling fearful of lows and your wife wants to go out for dinner and you say, no, I don't want to go out for that pasta because it's going to be too much of a burden for me. And so we're going to stay home tonight. And then it becomes a cycle and people get really, you know, spouses and partners and friends get annoyed because you're not willing to go out and be social. You're not willing to go out and live your life because you feel that diabetes is somehow a barrier there. On the flip side, there are some people with diabetes who live their lives, but the people around them are always hovering and worried about them. Whether that's a parent, whether that's a spouse, whether that's a friend who doesn't know anything about diabetes but thinks they do, there's a variety of ways. And that can cause this tension in relationships where people don't know. You know, one thing I'll say is that my in-laws don't know much about diabetes. However, they read my book. And it's actually been really impressive talking to them about the book because now they have a whole new insight into what life with diabetes is like and why my alarm goes off when they're at their house and what it means when I say, I can't play a game with you guys right now because my blood sugar is low. That insight for them has actually been transformative, I think, in seeing that I'm not making this stuff up. I'm not trying to avoid them, but that I really want to be a part of the family on a regular basis. But there are some times when I can't be.
I want to avoid my in-laws, but now, given that set of circumstances, do you give people kind of like exercises they can do to help get over these kind of things? Are there certain things these people should be doing so they don't have these kind of anxiety moments?
Around what?
Well, with a relationship. Okay. You know, so you've got, let's say I'm single, Amber's single. Let's say, you know, our partners.
Why are you outing me right there? Why are you outing me with being single?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I am available. Keep going.
See? Okay. As am I. So the point being is, are there things like, let's say you're talking to somebody that you tell them, say, okay, these are things you should try to get over this. Mm-hmm. So what do you recommend in those situations?
Yeah. So with a relationship, I think that the key word is boundaries. I mean, this is true for any relationship. But we're talking about diabetes specific boundaries. So somebody, you know, maybe you're on a date with somebody and they say, what's your blood sugar? Now depending on the relationship, that may be a boundary that's inappropriate. And so saying, you know, I am confident and competent to take care of my own blood, my diabetes, and I'll let you know if something is going on. On the other hand, when letting people know about what you're experiencing and what you're feeling and how they can help you and being very clear about that. You know, I think most people, most partners and friends, they want to be helpful, but they have no idea how to be. And sometimes we expect them to be able to be mind readers and know exactly what we need. And so being very clear as to what the rules are and how they can help you in that moment. My blood sugar is low. I need you to go get me a regular Coke, period. Go do it. As opposed to argue whether you want diet or regular.
Well, and I think one of the things too that we can is you're talking about boundaries and things and educating the loved one or the spouse, I mean, whomever that person is, or even a colleague. Hey, listen, sometimes you're going to hear beeps and this may mean this.
Right.
I can take action. I know what I need to do, but if I need help, I will ask you for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And be specific as to what you're needing. Or if you ever see me shaky or sweaty, or if I act irrational, it's not about you. It's about something else that's going on. Yeah, right. I mean, what could be? Yeah, right. I mean, hopefully not, but.
Yeah. I'll use a personal example. So I've been married for almost 11 years now. And when I first got married, my blood sugars were not in as good of a range as they were right now. I also was not working as a diabetes psychologist. But I had this syndrome, which I still have to some degree, called I'm fine syndrome, which is when my blood sugar is low, I'm fine. I don't need your help. I don't need any sugar either. Leave me alone. And it caused actually some conflict with my wife. And we came to an agreement that she wouldn't ask me about my blood sugars, that I would be able to take care of them on my own. However, if she ever noticed me acting weird or was worried about me, she could hand me orange juice, Smarties, some sort of sugar, and I would have to eat it. No questions asked. And that has made things much smoother because she hasn't asked questions but she also knows that if she's worried and for good reason, and she hands me something, I'm not going to argue with her. And so that's a boundary, right? We agreed that she would stay away unless she had good reason to think that she shouldn't. And if she didn't, then I had to let my boundary down and allow her in to my diabetes management.
Are you also finding, because we've created some new sections in our site to help patients save money and, you know, navigate some of these patient assistance programs. Are you finding the financial burden for a lot of patients to be interfering with, you know, creating more anxiety? And if you do, how are you telling them to deal with that?
Yeah, that's a tough situation. And absolutely, for people who have high deductible insurance plans or who don't have insurance and trying to pay for insulin, that is a high anxiety place to be. And first of all, is normalizing those experiences, letting them know that like that sucks and it sucks for all of us and it's scary. Also recognizing that I'm fortunate that I'm not dealing with that and not making them feel like I really understand because I really don't. The other thing is, so a couple of other things that I suggest is one is good communication with your healthcare providers. Letting them know what's going on because they have samples, they have access to coupon codes and to discount programs that we may not know about or that the average person with diabetes may not know about. Also, I think the most important thing in this process is becoming connected to the diabetes community because I don't know one person with diabetes who would leave another person with diabetes out to dry. I will give the CGM off my arm and the insulin out of my fridge to anybody who asks because I know how scary it can be to be, you know, on your last syringe worth of insulin. And that's not somewhere where any of us want people to be. And the diabetes community is the most giving community I've ever met. So that's not a solution, but certainly it's a way to develop a cocoon around yourself to become anti-fragile with diabetes. And that's something that we need to teach people with diabetes. And it amazes me how many patients I see where I'm the first person with diabetes they've ever talked to.
Wow.
And so one of the first things I do to every patient is ask them, are you willing to connect with other people? Whether that's on Instagram or Facebook, whether that's going to a meetup, whether that's just, you know, having a community, not your best friend, it could be, but it doesn't have to be, but just someone that you can reach out to or a Facebook group you can reach out to say, hey, I need some help. Anyone out there? And I know you'll get that. I know you'll get a response saying, sure, what can we do for you? And that is the best way to deal with that anxiety. We have bigger systemic issues to deal with, no doubt about it. But on a person by person basis, that's the advice that I give.
I love that. Well, and I want to talk more about, we want to touch more on your book and what people can expect, because I know it'll be out about the same time that the podcast comes out. So tell us a little bit about the title and—
This is your chance at a free commercial. Go for it.
Yeah. So my book is called Diabetes Sucks and You Can Handle It. Your guide to managing the emotional challenges of type 1 diabetes. And the book came to me, the concept for the book came to me about a year ago. I was actually meeting with a patient and he said to me, diabetes sucks. And my first response was, yes, it does. I totally agree, but you can handle it and so can I. It sent this light bulb off for me saying, I need to write a book about this. And so the book starts off by talking about how important it is for every single one of us to be honest with ourselves and with other people about the real challenges of type 1 diabetes. High blood sugars suck, low blood sugars suck, burnout sucks, the work sucks, a lot of it sucks. And if we're not honest with ourselves about those things, then we can't take action to address them. It's impossible to do that. But on the same note, sometimes we're dishonest with ourselves on the other end. My life is over because I have diabetes. I'm never going to be able to find a partner because I have diabetes. Diabetes is getting in my way and there's nothing I can do to go around it. And if we exaggerate the burdens of diabetes, and we all do this to a certain degree, I'm certainly guilty of it just as much as everybody else, then we're not able to address those issues because they're not even real issues. They're made up in our minds, our stories that we've told ourselves about what diabetes means about us and how much it sucks, that are impossible to address because they're not actually true. So the first part of the book is about learning to be honest with yourself about the real challenges that you face, as opposed to the challenges that you brush under the rug or exaggerate. And then the next part of the book is giving people skills that they can use, tangible skills that they can use to handle diabetes and handle the fact that it sucks. So for example, you're talking about using your data and leaning into your data as opposed to avoiding it. Letting go of control of things you have no control over, like your blood sugar in 5 hours, and really focusing on things you have control over right now, meaning how much insulin do I take? What do I eat for lunch? And being able to differentiate between those two things. And then helping people to handle stress. If we feel like we can't handle the stress of diabetes and can't handle the fact that diabetes sucks, then we've set ourselves up for failure before we even started. And so really want to give people the skills that they can use to be able to say, yeah, I can handle stress. I've been living with diabetes for almost 23 years, and I deal with the stress of diabetes every day. And really use the evidence that you've had from your own life to be able to see that you can handle it, even if it does suck. And to accept the fact that it sucks, but accept the fact that you're able to do what you want to do, or you can do what you want to do, even if it sucks. Because if we hold ourselves hostage to the fact that it sucks and say, I can't do anything until it doesn't suck anymore, well, all of a sudden now you're held hostage to that belief. But if you're able to see that it sucks, and say, I'm going to lead with action and do what I want to do, even though it's stressful and it does suck, then all of a sudden you've changed your mindset and become much more free and flexible.
Now, do you find that, is there a difference between, let's say, a type 1 and a type 2 and what they deal with?
Absolutely. Now, I will say that I only see people with type 1 diabetes, but I certainly have experience with folks with type 2. And with type 1, people know that they have an emotional burden, it's very apparent to them. Whether they're actually able to articulate it or not, they know that they have this constant stress on them that they have to focus on. And that weighs them down many times. For folks with type 2 diabetes, they may feel stressed, but they don't necessarily always or very often articulate that and address that to diabetes. They're not able to see that the constant worry about diabetes is on their minds. Many times because the way that type 2 diabetes is treated, a pill a day and then forget about it. Maybe you should be thinking about your diet and exercise, but really it's a pill a day and forget about it. Or, you know, maybe an injection a day and then nothing until tomorrow. And until type 2 diabetes progresses to a point where you're taking multiple daily injections or you need an insulin pump or you're using a CGM, it's really out of sight, out of mind for many people. And so that's a great way to avoid the emotional burden, but also to avoid managing diabetes, which then increases the emotional burden later on because you have health issues that come from that. sometimes.
I want to throw something out to you because I participated in a mental health week-long retreat about 4 years ago, and I didn't realize the reason for being there was being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at such a young age. So there was this incredible amount of trauma and things like that that I had never addressed. Even though I'd been in therapy and I'd done all these things, I never knew diabetes was my demon, for lack of a better term. With that being said, pieces of advice or things that are coming from this book, you know, and I have a whole list of things. So when I have those moments of I'm angry with the situation, I go through my affirmations and I go through this list to remind myself that diabetes is not me. This is just a part of me. And so do you address that in your book? And can you give any tips on when somebody's in that mindset or whether it's burnout or whatnot, how you can bring them back down to a calm place?
Yes, I address it in a couple different ways. One of my favorite techniques, which is talked about a lot in the book, is mindfulness. And what mindfulness is being aware of your experience in the present moment without judging it. So saying, being aware, labeling what you're experiencing. I feel stressed. I'm feeling burnt out. I'm feeling low. I'm feeling high. All of those things. And just, but that doesn't mean anything about me. It just means that's how I'm feeling right now. So that's one thing. Another thing that I do in the book is talking about how we deal with our thoughts. So I don't know about you, but I know that I have thousands of thoughts a day, and many of them are off the wall crazy. And we all do. That's part of it.
Thank you for admitting that. I feel the same way.
It's the way the human mind is wired. But one of my favorite stories that I use in the book is, imagine that you walk into Target today and there's a sign on the wall and on the door at Target saying, we have a new policy in the store today. If you touch it, you have to buy it. I mean, that would be absurd. And if that were the case for me, I would be the proud owner of a lot of really ugly women's clothes, because I'm a tactile person. So I'll walk through Target and I'll just like touch everything that I see. Now, of course, that's a silly policy that Target would have. And none of us could ever imagine shopping at Target like that. But we have the same policy for our thoughts. If I think it, I have to buy it. If I think diabetes sucks, it must be true. If I think that diabetes is my demon, it must be true. But what would happen if you change the way that you related to the thought? You can't get rid of it. It's going to be there. And no matter how much you try to control it, it's still going to come back. But instead of buying it, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to buy this and, you know, I'm going to make it part of me, you just notice it. It's like you go to Target and you want to buy a new toaster. And so you pick up five toasters and pick out the one based on your budget and your needs. Do the same thing with your thoughts. Notice that it's there. Don't try to get rid of it, but just decide which one you want to buy and let the other ones go.
Now, tell everybody, before I forget, because I want to make sure we can plug this as much as we possibly can, where do they buy the book? How do they get it? And I assume you have published other books, and or is this the first one?
This is number one.
Oh, well, congratulations. Let's make this a bestseller. How do our listeners get it?
Yeah, so the best way to get it is on Amazon. Okay. You go to Amazon.com and go to and put in diabetes sex sneaky handle, and you can put in Mark Heyman. You can also buy it on my website, which will link to Amazon, by the way, at thediabetespsychologist.com.
Okay, because we'll have all this information on the website, so all our listeners will have it, but we want you to plug this away, and we think it's a great idea. If in a way of kind of doing a wrap here, tell us what's next for you. Are you going to, you published one book, you know, you obviously have a successful practice. I mean, you think you'll do another book, you know, what's next?
I haven't had my first baby yet. David, how could I talk about my second one?
No. Get some rest.
Really. So my goal as a diabetes psychologist is to support people with type 1 diabetes and their mental health in whatever way that I can. And the way that I think about diabetes mental health is on a continuum. So imagine that there are 100 people in a room who have type 1 diabetes. There may be two or three of those folks who need to see me or someone like me in my practice. But there's another 97 people who need something else. And that's not me. That may be my book. That may be my podcast, the Diabetes Psychologist. That may be an Instagram post. That may be I have a digital course called Get Unstuck with Type 1 Diabetes, where it takes people kind of through a step-by-step process over the course of 6 weeks to help them to learn these skills in a really tactical way and practice them. I have a membership program where people can sign up and get weekly coaching sessions with me over Zoom in a group setting, get monthly resources. And all of those things really go to the place where I want to make sure that people are getting the resources they need at a price they can afford, but also at the place they are with their diabetes. Because if we say everyone needs therapy, everyone could certainly benefit from therapy, but everyone doesn't need therapy. So how can we give people the thing that they need at the place they are on their diabetes right here, right now? And that's really my goal. And so continue to develop those resources.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. And before we close it, I am curious, because you did bring up something there.
Yeah.
they always say the first step solving a problem is knowing that you got one. Mm-hmm. And do you find, and I think I know the answers, but I want to hear it anyway. Do you find that like that it's almost an aha moment for some of these type ones who like, oh my God, I really do have emotional issue with diabetes?
Yeah, I think they've already known it. They have always known it. However, they haven't been able to label it and know that not only is there a name for it, but it's also normal and that other people experience it. And for that, that is a powerful healing tool to know that you're not alone, that what you're experiencing isn't crazy, isn't abnormal, and that there's things that you can do to navigate around that. And so it doesn't have to get in your way.
Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. And I know you haven't had your first baby yet, but when you're pregnant with your second one,
we're going to have let us know.
So you can promote that one too. It's been really great. We really appreciate having you.
Well, thank you so much, David and Amber. I appreciate it too.